Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without good old Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I have the pleasure of telling you that Carlos Fuentes is here with me in the studio to talk about his new book, Destiny and Desire. This is the first of a two-part interview. To talk to Carlos Fuentes is to speak with one of the most glorious and noble writers in the world. I'm not going to speak myself. I'm going to let the novelist and critic Paul West speak for me in this quote. Carlos Fuentes is a man of parts with many roles. The versatility, which is the hallmark of his excellence, applies to him as a fiction writer too. There is Fuentes, the discreet implier, concerned with special and not always definable states of mind, as in aura and distant relations. There is Fuentes, the voluminous, wide-handed visionary for whom nothing is too small, too big, to go into his homage to the planet Terra Nostra. There is the severely moving Fuentes of the death of Artemio Cruz, who masters the forlorn, the poignant, with impetuous vivacity. There is the Fuentes whose work happens to be narrated by a fetus. And now, Michael Silverblatt speaking, there is the Fuentes of Destiny and Desire, a novel narrated by a severed head. In this way, the severed head is, well, you know, a fortune teller. Magicians worked with brazen heads who told the truth, but also we're dealing with the assassinations in Mexico, where, as in this novel, the severed head says that he's the 1,000th this month, the first in the last 3.5 hours. He's floating in the Pacific, telling us his story before he drowns. And what is he foretelling?
This severed head is not severed by crime, but by ambition. He's severed by a woman who wants to get all the heirs of the millionaire Max Monroy out of the way, so as to be the sole heiress, one of the oldest stories in the world. And that is why he dies, not part of organized crime, although she uses criminals. It is part of organized ambition and what drives her to eliminate all people who would come between her and the great fortune of Max Monroy. Max Monroy has one of his sons in jail. The other two he ignores. He visits his wife, who's a mad woman, in the lunatic asylum, etc.
So, in other words, it's a Fuentes novel.
Of course it is. Very good, Michael. Very good. There you are.
And, you know, I would say the best in many. It's my favorite. I've read them all in these recent years. And in particular, it's my favorite because it describes a condition that obtains in the modern world in which both government and business are turning to crime. That crime becomes the face that government and business presents to the world. This seems to be a tragedy not only of literature, but of
But it's the tragedy of a world that is ending, Michael. I think the world we are living in is coming to an end. We don't know what will follow, but something is coming.
And in this book, Destiny and Desire, there are two brothers, one of whom, two friends, nearly brothers, who go to work.
Yeah.
One in government, one in business, both of them guided by boundless ambition, but one capable of being instructed. He's taught Spinoza. He's taught moderation by an early teacher. The other, really, the government, the politician, much more darkly corrupt. The book wants to say, ultimately, the sky meets the sea. Oppositions are one. Are these two men, this Cain and Abel, are they, in fact, the same?
They're not the same. They are part of the same world. They are a divided self, if you wish. But they're the oldest story in the world. They're Cain and Abel. You've just said it. One usually goes to the Bible or Greek tragedy and epic to find the models for modern writing. So I went to Cain and Abel, and because there is a basic wrenching of the soul there, a separation of brotherhood, separation of the first family of all. And they go in different paths. One kills the other. And here he is the intermediary for the death of Abel is Cain, but the destiny of Cain is no better than that of Abel, finally. So, yes, you're right. It's an old fable in a modern setting, and it is told by a man whose head is floating in the sea, but it says, wait a moment, I still have something to tell you. And that tale takes 500 pages, quite a head. Quite a tongue, quite yes. A memory, because it's his last chance. If he doesn't talk then, he'll never talk again. He'll be washed away and forgotten completely. He's already separated from his body.
Now, Carlos, this book seems to work through a series of camouflages, of red herrings, because although these brothers are Cain and Abel, their names in English would be Joshua and Jericho. Yeah. Now, they wear disguises, and disguises are essential to this novel in which, true to the tradition of the novel, everyone is ultimately related, just as we are all children of Adam and Eve.
Well, it's a human comedy. It's Balzac. It's the same way the characters reappear, and all of them keep coming up. You can't separate them from the totality of the human comedy. And I've very Balzacian in nature. When I read Balzac at 21 in Paris, I discovered a world. And I've tried to keep close to the Balzacian spirit of telling the same novel with different titles. But it's only one novel, and characters reappear. And now some characters of past novels reappear in this one. But basically, it's a novel that does have its scenery contemporary Mexico. The Mexico of today, but always with this mythological bottom of the sea, which is strangely common to all men, belongs to us all. Then you surface and there are differences. But basically we have a few well-worn myths. They serve us well. We repeat them. They're part of our soul.
So in other words, in our depths, we have this myth that binds us. Mm-hmm. It's only on the surface.
Yeah.
That our story changes.
The surface has changed a lot, but the deepest pit of the ocean is common to us all. Yeah.
And not only are there stories that recur, every story in the world circulates.
Yeah.
So that the story of Adam and Eve begins in Sumeria. All of our stories are global.
They're all global. That is what we have taken some time to discover. I feel that the American readership and critics have more or less cut themselves off from what is happening in the rest of the world. It was not so when I started publishing with Forrest Strauss, and you published Sella and Mauriac and Moravia, a lot of foreign writers. This is less so today, and I'm afraid of that. It worries me that there should be this reduced relationship of one of the principal world literatures, which is that of the United States, with the rest of the world. We should try to reconnect through people like you, Michael. I think it's a duty to reconnect the United States with the literature of the world.
I'm talking to Carlos Fuentes. He is the author of Destiny and Desire, set in Mexico City. Mexico City is, after all, one of the world centers of culture. Mexico has a vast culture, and the novel is there to show us how many forms and at how many places the culture joins the global ocean.
You know, Mexico is one of the oldest cultures, the oldest culture in the Americas, the oldest surviving culture, the oldest city for the Americas, in that sense, is Mexico City, Mexico Tenochtitlan, the Aztec city, which was a great metropolis of more than 300,000 people in 1519 when the Spaniards, when Hernán Cortés arrived. So it has this vast memory of a huge past, which goes on developing. So it is the space, the locale of the novel, in the same way that Dublin is the locale for Joyce or Paris is the locale for Balzac, but it's only part of the story. What comes after the location of the story is what is really interesting. I'm not writing a tourist guide of Mexico City. Balzac is not writing a tourist guide of Paris. We are doing a basic space, a settlement, which every writer needs. Unless you do science fiction, you need a real city, a real place, real people, and then you go off and tell a story in literary terms. You forget where you are in a way, and you start developing what is not there, which is the story and the characters.
What I love in a Fuentes novel is that there will be characters of action, but as well, there are philosophers who narrate what it is to think about the subject of the novel you're reading. There are writers as well. One of these characters sits in the courtyard typing love letters for those without Spanish. Yes. Now, let's bear in mind, around 20% of the population of Mexico does not speak Spanish. But how do they read your work? How do they discover your
work?
They don't.
Literature in Mexico is read by a minority. A book of mine, if it sells 50,000 copies, is a huge success. There are a few cases like García Márquez who can sell hundreds of thousands of books. But a book like Destiny and Desire has sold about 50,000 copies in Mexico. It's a huge success, but no more than that. Let's say that each book is bought by one person and read by four, optimistically. Mm-hmm. That would give you 100,000 people in a population of 110 million. So it's a small readership, but it tends to filter down and affect people in other indirect ways. Just the marvel of literature, that the act of a minority, a book, a novel, should finally filter down into the sensibility of a majority, which is what happens with great novels or interesting novels. In any case, that is my case, that I feel that I would write anyway for one reader. I don't care. It is the joy of writing that really impels me to write. I have a great joy of sitting every morning and writing the book. But then if it is published, and if I get one reader, it'll be enough. It gets 50,000 readers multiplied by four. That's wonderful. And it filters down in ways I never suspect to persons I'd never knew existed that come up to me and said, your character so-and-so, you said so-and-so. How did they get there? That is a mystery. I think every writer knows that and is not satisfied with the statistics of the novel, but with the influence of the novel. There are books that are not read in their lifetime. Stendhal comes to mind as a great example of a writer who was not read for almost 100 years. After his death, Henri Martinon rediscovered Stendhal in the 1920s. He came back to life as a classic. But that happens, you know.
But how do we feel sure that what today may be an elite will be the future of the literary? Can we be sure?
No, we have to work from out of darkness and ignorance, doing what we feel we must do, what we're sure we must do, even if we have no readers at the moment. Maybe someday we will, maybe someday we won't. But that is not the question. The question is the great joy of writing, of creativity, and of addressing yourself to an audience you don't know. Finally, I get to see, thanks to you and coming to California and giving lectures, some of the faces of an audience that otherwise I would not know. But I know it's there. And I write because they're there, even if I don't know them. But there's a give and take between the unknown and the writer, which is very mysterious and very good for writing.
Now tell me, in this book, Destiny and Desire, the women characters seem extraordinary to me, in particular two. A mother who speaks from beyond the grave and is a kind of prophet. Mm-hmm. She is a very powerful mother. And another powerful woman who is the mistress of the head of business. Yes. You know, she is the one who is darkly exterminating her rivals because mm-hmm. she wants to inherit everything. Yeah. She's kind of Lilith figure, but very pragmatic. Why these extraordinary women?
I think Mexico is a country of extraordinary women. I know a lot of them because it is a country that has the seal of machismo. Mexico is supposed to be a country where the values of the man are superior to those of the woman. Therefore, we have extraordinary women because they have to fight against the commonplace of Mexico as a macho country. It suddenly has women. You know, the actress Maria Félix represented that role. She was there to be a central figure of a woman, like Barbara Stanwyck in your movies. She's always, she. Whatever happens, she is the mistress of the movie, even if she's subjected to men. The final thing she made as a cowgirl, an old cowgirl, she's still the central figure. She dominates the figure. That comes from cultures that are very male-oriented. You have to have women who oppose that and who affirm themselves more than they would in a country like France or England, let's say.
I'm talking with Carlos Fuentes, the great and greatest living Mexican writer, the author of Destiny and Desire, published by Random House. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. Now, we have an exciting opportunity for the admirers of Carlos Fuentes. We have in our brand new online store 50 signed copies of Destiny and Desire. The quantity, as you see, is limited, so don't delay. Go to kcrw.com/store and purchase a copy of Carlos Fuentes' new novel. Carlos Fuentes and I will be back after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Carlos Fuentes about Destiny and Desire, a novel set in Mexico City in which all of mythology and philosophy, everything available, takes place. Now, in this Mexico City, the presiding philosopher is Machiavelli. Can you tell me why?
I think he's the presiding philosopher of the world. I compare him. There are three great thinkers who make their appearance almost at the same time. With 15 years difference, you have Thomas More's Utopia, Erasmus and the Praise of Folly, and Machiavelli and the Prince. Now, who is actually present in the politics of the world? It is Machiavelli. You can have a desire to have a utopia, as Moore's, or you can sit back and be ironical, as Erasmus does in The Price of Folly. But in practical life, it is the triumph of Machiavelli. Machiavelli runs the world from his Florentine grave. As I put him here, he says, what the hell? I've always presented as a political philosopher. I loved women. I loved song. I loved disguises. I loved men. I loved the humanity of the world, and not only the mind of the world. Yet he always is accepted, of course, as the great political philosopher.
And yet, you see, Machiavelli, read in every humanities course worldwide, has become the prophet of the global yearning politically mm-hmm. for the expedient.
Yeah.
And in Destiny and Desire, he is, unfortunately, the reality of what is being presented yeah. as Mexican business and Mexican politics today. Here we have the worst, as for many people, the sexual guide is sod. you know, you've had to write a book in which the worst prevails. What is that like for the writer?
First, there are no happy novels. Happy ending novels are very rare. One would be probably The Idiots, and the other would be Don Quixote and Pickwick Papers. I can think of no other. Generally, novels are to remind people that things turn out badly. This country we are in, your country, the United States of America, which has been the land of opportunity, freedom, and the pursuit of happiness, is also a land where you can't find almost a single positive writer. They're all very negative, from Poe right down to Jonathan Franzen. They're all saying, this is terrible. We live in a terrible world. I think it's only probably Mark Twain who loves the Mississippi and all that, but the rest are extremely critical writers.
But Mark Twain knows we live in a terrible world. Yeah. From beyond the grave, he has his devils warning us about what we're making.
200 years, huh?
Yes, before we allowed it to be published.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, yes, yes. But, you know, yes, literature is about how things go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So how does a writer who is, as you've said, the bird that bears bad news, mm-hmm. the little bird that has a dark truth. How does the writer live in possession of this knowledge?
Well, he writes the book. There's no other way. You can't be as pessimistic in real life as you are in a book. You concentrate that. Dostoevsky was an example of a man who was almost as difficult as his books in the sense of unhappiness. But generally, no, Tolstoy was a great patriarch, and even Balzac had a great jolly time eating and drinking. And so you concentrate what you feel that is not being said, Michael. The things that are not being said by your society is what you put into a novel. The novel is the other face, the other coin of a society that loves to praise itself, to say how wonderful I am. I remember my wife was once interviewing Carlos Andrés Pérez, the former president of Venezuela, and she asked him, what do you think of this guide for political leaders, which is Machiavelli's The Prince? Said, I don't read The Prince. I read The Little Prince, which is a better guide.
Oh, yes.
Better guide.
And don't we need both? Okay, Carlos, you wake up in the morning and you write. Having made notes the night before, the dreams you have influence your notes,
yes.
And you write them down so that the books are widely known, as in the quote by Paul West, for taking many strange and remarkable turns and for containing multitudes of thought, multitudes of dreams, of parodies, of genres. Do you ultimately know what the novel you've completed is?
No, of course not. First, I know what I want to write in the evening. Go to sleep, I get up, and I write something. That is what I thought, but something new at the same time, something I had not thought of. It comes from dreams or madness or inheritance, I don't know what. But it appears there, and I write it, I say, I'd never thought of this. Where did it come from? It's very mysterious. And then you die and you leave a book that will be subject to interpretation. And in life itself, I always let the reader have the last word. These are open books. The final pages are open to the reader for him to continue the novel. I cannot write without knowing that there is a reader who will continue the book, who will not end the book, but continue it and pass it on to another and another and another. That is, for me, the great satisfaction and beauty of writing.
Now, sometimes your novels become, to my mind, I'll follow them, and it will take the third reading before I understand, because
and you're Michael.
I'm Michael, yes. But, you know, I'm fascinated.
Yeah.
I loved Distant Relations. That was a book in which surrealism was claimed for Spanish literature, not for French literature. And by the end, there is a surrealist phantasmagoria, as there is in Destiny and Desire, where what we feel we know, the solid ground, leaves from beneath us, and we have to subject ourselves to a kind of visionary condition that the novel brings without interpreting for us. I'm very interested in this.
Well, you're the destiny and the desire of the novel. This is what I try to attempt to do. The novel is in your hands, in your imagination, and possibly in your dreams. It is does not belong to me anymore. You know, I seldom reread myself. Sometimes I have to for the purposes of translation. I don't like it. I leave a book and say, now it does not belong to me. It belongs to the readers of the book, that they make what they want of it. And this has to do with what you just said. I cannot work otherwise than by giving you, the reader, you, Michael, that freedom.
Yes, but how do you surrender Carlos? Carlos has his ideas. It seems as if the books enter a phase where they're not being guided.
Yes. I forget. The novel is a work of freedom because, contrary to what happens in private or public life, especially in public life, everybody has a right to say what he has to say or what she has to say. This, for me, is very important. I am not in favor of this or that character. I'm not blaming any character for what he or she say. You mentioned Assunta Jordán. Probably I don't agree with her as much as I do with the other forlorn young woman, Lucha Zapata, in the book. But I'm letting them both have their say. They're both going to say what they have to say and tell us who they are. There's no other way of writing novels. You have to accept the reasons of your enemy, even in a novel, of those who do not think like you. You can blame them in a newspaper, op-ed piece, but you cannot in a novel. The novel is a moral place in that sense, that it permits everyone to have his say or her say. It does permit it, and we do hear it in a way that we know is not the personal thinking of Dostoevsky or Tolstoy or William Faulkner.
I've been talking with Carlos Fuentes, author most recently of Destiny and Desire, published by Random House. Thank you, Carlos, for joining me.
Great to be with you always, Michael. We'd be in the high mountains and the sierras or on the coast. Always a pleasure.
Thank you. You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Destiny and Desire at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with the click of a button on our media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm. He is a bookworm. She is a bookworm. We are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
A bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. And we're just read this, I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.